This program was recorded at InterVarsity's Following Christ Conference, held in Chicago, December 27th through 31st, 2008.
Welcome back. How many of you went outside in the cold weather for lunch? I haven't been outside, so I just assumed it was cold, but maybe it's not cold. It's above freezing. All right. Okay. I want to introduce our first speaker now. Dr. Jim Bradley has such a wide variety of experience that I think even if you're not a mathematician, you will find this talk and him to be delightful. He is the Vice President for Physical and Mathematical Sciences at the John Templeton Foundation. He's responsible for creating large-scale funding initiatives at Templeton in the mathematical and physical sciences, on such themes as the nature of randomness, the role of information in evolutionary theory, and the neuroscience of mathematical thought. He is also working to expand the Foundation's efforts in the core areas of physics and cosmology. Before joining the Foundation, Jim was a tenured professor in the Department of Mathematics and Statistics at Calvin College in Grand Rapids, Michigan. He served as Calvin's Director of Assessment and Institutional Research and as a visiting scholar at the U.S. State Department working on arms control issues. Prior to his appointment at Calvin, he held professorships at Nazareth College and Roberts Wesleyan College. He received his undergraduate degree in mathematics at MIT, a master's in computer science at the Rochester Institute of Technology, and a PhD in mathematics from the University of Rochester. He's authored or co-authored 3 textbooks, 20 scholarly papers written on a variety of subjects from mathematical models of referendum voting to St. Augustine's views on the philosophy of mathematics. So as I understand it, he and his wife also enjoy Asian cooking. Yes. So with this tremendous variety of talent, and I should say that he and I also had a recent adventure in China together with the John Templeton Foundation. So I think we will all enjoy what he has to say. So Jim, welcome. Please give us a broad view.
Okay, thank you very much, Jennifer. We had a very interesting time in Beijing. I met Jennifer there after she'd been about 24 hours without sleep. And I can tell you she was, well, not quite as animated as she is today. But I want to talk to you about the theme of ideas in the mind of God, reflections on mathematics and Christian belief. I'm very much conscious that most of you are not mathematicians. But nevertheless, I saw quite a few of you in physics, a number in chemistry, so I'm sure you use mathematics in significant ways. And if you're one of those folks that does not, at least treat my talk as an example of how someone can take a particular scientific discipline and try to reflect on the relationship between science and that particular discipline and their Christian belief. There's a widespread perspective on the relationship between mathematics and Christian belief, which kind of looks like this. Some years ago, I was working on a book, I was co-editing a book titled Mathematics in the Postmodern Age, A Christian Perspective, and I was telling a friend of mine about this, that we were trying to talk about the relationship between mathematics and Christian belief, and she looked at me very quizzically and made the comment, she said, "That's going to be one short book." It turned out to be close to 400 pages, and it turns out that there's really quite a lot to say when you get into it. But this is the common perspective, and it has, I think, very serious consequences. Let me just give you a concrete example. When I was in graduate school, I was at the University of Rochester, and there were 50 graduate students in mathematics in our department, and there were 3 of us that went with some regularity to InterVarsity Christian Fellowship get-togethers. Of those 3, I was the only one to actually finish a PhD. And the reason was that the other 2 both decided that they wanted to do something with their life where they could more clearly establish a relationship between their faith and their career. They dropped out of mathematics because they saw it this way. Okay? And this is not unusual. Folks who are committed to the Lord, who want to serve Him, end up seeing this kind of dichotomy and say, "No, I think I'll pursue something else." Other folks who really do love the discipline, stay in it, somehow manage to dichotomize their thinking and end up, really, for much of their career, operating in this kind of a mold. And I'm the sort of person who just can't handle this. I mean, I've got to be able to put things together. I've got to find some way to bridge these kind of gaps. And so this is became something of a project for me that I've worked on for quite a few years. There's a mathematician from MIT named Giancarlo Rota, who's very well known. He's dead now, but he was a very articulate spokesperson for mathematics. And he made this comment, which I found very, very helpful. He said, mathematicians need to realize that the formal axiomatic process is not mathematics. It is a way of doing mathematics. Let me explain what I mean by that, or what I think Rota meant by that. If you look at mathematics simply as a process of taking formally described axioms and thinking deductively about what you can prove from those, and if that is mathematics, indeed, that model that we looked at earlier probably is the right way to look at it. There probably isn't much connection between mathematics and Christian belief. But if you begin to look at mathematics from a different perspective, you see that only as a way of doing mathematics, and get a different perspective on the discipline as a whole, things look very different. Mathematics has enormous connections with the natural sciences, especially physics, but it's becoming more and more important in biology these days and chemistry. In fact, it's extremely important in the social sciences, primarily through the medium of statistics, but there's many other ways as well. Voting models, for instance, are highly mathematical. Almost any kind of social structure one tries to design in terms of business decision-making models, other types of approaches are very, very mathematical. And so mathematics has connections with all kinds of other disciplines. If you also begin to consider the amount of money that our culture invests in training mathematics teachers, in bringing up children to know mathematics, we can see that there's a huge social investment in mathematics. And in fact, if we begin to think about some of the ethics of some of this and some of the priorities we set on it, begin to ask questions like, well, why did God give us the ability to do mathematics? What's his purpose for all this? We can begin to see that there's a huge scope of questions relating mathematics to Christian belief that is possible to explore. And so we can begin to break down that strict dichotomy that we saw in that model at the beginning. Well, what I want to do in this talk is, and there are so many things we could explore, that I want to focus in quite sharply just on two much smaller themes. I'm going to take one area of mathematics, namely the philosophy of mathematics, which is not a technical dimension, somewhat more non-technical dimension, but I want to talk about, a little about the philosophy of mathematics and how that can be related to Christian belief. And then I want to talk a little bit about how mathematics came to be to have this kind of strict dichotomy that we looked at earlier. That is, how did that come about? And then we can begin to think together about what we might do about that. So let's start with the philosophy of mathematics. I'm going to ask you a question to kick us off. Could God have created a world in which 7 plus 3 does not equal 10 without changing the meanings of 7 plus 3 equals 10? Okay. Could God do that? God is sovereign, right? God is omniscient and omnipotent. On the other hand, it doesn't quite make sense to say 7 plus 3 doesn't equal 10. So I'm going to take a vote. And there's no abstentions allowed. You have to choose one or the other. Just if you're not really unsure, just pick whichever way you seem to be leaning. Okay. How many of you say yes, God could in fact have created such a world? See your hands. How many of you say God could not have created such a world? Well, we have a clear majority. God could not have done it. End of discussion. Right. Okay. Let's move on. What I want to do is I want to talk to you about Augustine's philosophy of mathematics. It's quite a surprise to most people that St. Augustine had a lot to say about mathematics. But in the process of that, we're going to see how Augustine would answer this question. But we need to do a little background in understanding Augustine's philosophy first before we see this answer. Okay, so Augustine was born in 356 A.D., died in 427. So he lived around 400 A.D. in that area, lived in North Africa, spoke Latin. I don't think it's unfair to say that he's probably the most influential Christian thinker outside the biblical writers. He was much influenced by Plato. So Greek thought had a very important role in his thinking. Even though he never read a word of Greek. He had to read it all in translation. He's been criticized by Protestant thinkers for being so much influenced by the Greeks. He was also criticized in his own time for drawing so much on the Greeks. And he had an interesting response to that. He took the story from Exodus, where God called the Israelites to leave Egypt, and he told them that at the time of the Exodus, they were to go to their Egyptian neighbors and were to ask them for gold, silver, other valuable things, and to take those with them when they left. Okay. And thereby, they took much of the treasure of Egypt with them. And Augustine says that that's a metaphor for what we're called to do living in secular cultures. We are called to take the best of those secular cultures, even if the people who have those things are unbelievers, have no relationship to the faith at all. We are free to appropriate those kind of things and make use of them and enjoy them. And so he felt that this was appropriate for him to do with Platonic thought in particular. To my mind, it's a very encouraging thing. As we live in secular worlds, secular universities, and work with secular science, again, that this metaphor would encourage us to feel free to appropriate whatever's the best of all of that secular knowledge. He wrote a book titled On Free Choice of the Will around 395 AD, and this has a significant section on the philosophy of mathematics, and that's what I'm going to be primarily drawing on in my following remarks. Okay, so what is the philosophy of mathematics? Well, there's four main themes. If that looks like five to you, it's clear you don't understand the philosophy of mathematics. the third, 3A and 3B are so closely related that I couldn't find any way to combine them into one, so we really have these four themes. Let me kind of walk you through them. Ontology. What is the nature of things? Right? Think about mathematical objects. Think about something as simple as numbers, like 3 or 4 or 7. What is this? I mean, is it a standalone thing in itself that has some independent identity? Or is it just kind of a notation, a convenient way of talking to each other? Is it a kind of an abstraction of a pattern? Is it a property of sets? I mean, what exactly is a number? And if you want to think of more abstract objects, like vector spaces or groups, for those of you that are into that kind of mathematical jargon, what are these things? Well, they clearly aren't material objects. I mean, where's the atoms and the molecules in three? So if they're not material, are they spiritual? Are they like angels? So what exactly, what's the nature of these things? All right, that's the ontology question. All right, epistemology. Well, this is how do we come to know mathematics? How do we come to understand mathematical objects? And this is currently the main area of focus in the philosophy of mathematics today. This is where most of the energy is being put forth in much of the current work. The classic formulation of it is, let's suppose we accept the idea that mathematical objects are abstract entities, that they're non-material. How do we, who are material beings, come to understand these things? How do we get access as material beings to something that's not material? Okay. That's the epistemological question. How do we come to know these? Now, a lot of current philosophers have said, well, really what mathematical objects are just arrangements of neurons in our brains. We all share very similar DNA, therefore we share very similar patterns in our brains. And so therefore, these things are going to have similar patterns in all of our minds, so it's not like you have your own three and I have my three, and we all have our own three. We share this because we share a common DNA. But nevertheless, these things are fundamentally material objects, and that's how we get access to it. It's not altogether satisfying, even for people who are not thoroughgoing materialists. And so if there's some sense in which these objects are abstract things, how do we get access to them? Okay, the meaning of truth. Well, I suspect, is there anybody here in this room who has any doubts about the truth of the Pythagorean theorem? Right? A squared plus B squared equals C squared for right triangles. You have some doubts about it? Okay, you can leave now. but most of us are pretty well convinced of the truth of this. And yet, on what basis? This is certainly not something that's revealed in Scripture. In fact, the Bible never even mentions it. So we tend to have this great deal of confidence in this truth, but it doesn't come in any sense by revelation. I'm getting more into the second question. How do we account for the certainty of this kind of truth? the first question about the meaning of it, it's not quite the same as scientific truth. It's not like we've observed some data and then made some sort of an inference from it and seen a pattern. So it's certainly not that kind of truth. Is it the same kind of truth that Jesus was talking about when he said, "I am the way, the truth, and the life"? I'm not so sure about that either. So anyway, that's the question. What does it mean to say that a theorem is true? And what sense is it true? Okay. And then, so how do we account for this great deal of confidence we tend to have in mathematical truth? It seems to be much stronger than our confidence in any kind of scientific truth. And the last one is effectiveness. How do we account for the effectiveness of mathematical thinking? Let me give my favorite example of this. When Einstein's theory of general relativity was first put forth, it was seen as very obscure, very complex, and not particularly helpful. Most physicists said, why do we need all this huge machinery for something that doesn't seem to give us very much benefit? And Einstein was a little bit lame in his answers to that. He wasn't quite sure either. Nevertheless, as people began to look at it, one of the predictions that it made was that light would bend as it passed near a large object, like a sun. So during an eclipse of the sun, this was tested, and indeed, light not only bent as it, from a distant star, not only bent as it passed the sun, but it bent by just the amount that Einstein's theory predicted. Now, here's the question. How is it that somebody just manipulating, writing down symbols on a sheet of paper, manipulating according to certain formal rules, ends up predicting a phenomenon in nature, in the physical universe, that had never been observed before? In fact, to my knowledge, hadn't even been anticipated. How in the world is there this connection between what we do, just manipulating these symbols according to our rules, and the extremely distant phenomena of this physical world? How do we account for this? Okay, so that's the effectiveness question. So this is what the philosophy of mathematics is about, is addressing these kinds of questions. Let me walk you through Augustine's answers to these questions. First of all, ontology. For Augustine, mathematical objects, well, at least the natural numbers, are ideas in the mind of God and have been from eternity. They've always been in God's mind. Okay? And God used these then as patterns in making the physical universe. Epistemology. How do we come to know about these things, these ideas in God's mind? Well, Augustine says this. He says, the elementary truths of mathematics are present to all who think. They are neither deduced nor induced, but perceived. Very interesting. We don't deduce these from some more fundamental principles. We don't induce these. We don't infer these from our experience. Our knowledge of three is not the result of having seen lots of groups of three things and observing a common pattern and saying, aha, I see a pattern there. There's three. Or a pattern of a group of 1,000 things. Aha, I see a pattern. Now I understand the concept of 1,000. No, he says it's not that way. He says that we perceive these things. And they're not perceived by our bodily senses. Our understanding of infinity is enough to prove that. He says that even, he points out, even young children have at least a bit of an intuitive concept of infinity. That is, even preschoolers can understand the idea that there's no such thing as a largest number. I remember my daughter insisting one time that I had to tell her, she was about 4, I think, at the time, I had to tell her what the biggest number was. And so I said, there can't be one. She says, nonsense, there has to be one. So I said, well, all right, let's suppose we've got it. She said, yes. I said, okay, now add one to it, and you'll have a bigger number. Oh, she said. And she tried it off happily and went off to play. But this is the basic, I gave her a basic, simple mathematical proof, and she understood it. So Augustine argues that the fact that we have this intuitive understanding of infinity, even though it's impossible for us ever to actually experience infinity, is enough in itself to establish the fact that our knowledge of mathematics is not the result of our bodily senses. With what are we perceiving it? Augustine argues, in essence, that we have a mathematical sixth sense. We have sort of an internal mathematical sense that transcends our bodily senses. And it's more foundational than our bodily senses. In fact, he would argue that it informs our bodily senses. That is, we don't ever experience sensorily with our physical senses the concept of one. But the concept of oneness is something we bring to our physical experiences and informs it. Well, this is an intriguing and fascinating idea. He's arguing in a sense that there's a certain amount of mathematics simply hardwired into the human brain from basically genetically, really. Current advances in neuropsychology are beginning to show that that may be right. But I think we may be in a position to actually be able to settle this question from a neuroscience point of view in the next few years. So there's some fascinating research. This brings us right up to the cutting edge of some research that's going on now or in the fairly near future. He also argues that this kind of these numbers and other mathematical structures are accessible to anyone who uses reason. And I've heard some people really dispute that one, but we'll let that go. All right. So what is a truth then? From Augustine's point of view, a truth is a necessary and therefore immutable proposition. That is, it's a proposition. So truth for Augustine is propositional. It's statements made in language. And secondly, they're statements that cannot not be true, that cannot be any other way. They're necessary, they're immutable, they can't possibly change, they're eternal, and they're common to all minds that contemplate them. He says that some items of rational knowledge are truths. The inverse square law of astronomy is not a truth, according to this definition. It may be true, but it's not a truth. Presumably, if we had a four-dimensional rather than a three-dimensional universe, that is, four physical dimensions rather than three, we'd have an inverse cube law. So in this sense, it's a contingent truth, contingent on the particular structure of the physical universe we live in. Right? Truths, in this sense, are not contingent. They cannot not be true. Well, here's some examples of truths. Can you folks in the backs read those? Okay, I won't bother to read through those for you. Just read through them yourself. These are some examples that Augustine gives of truths. Notice he's chosen diverse kinds of things. The first one deals with personal ethics, and then there's intellectual activity, social justice, values, what it means to live a good life. So he's tried to set out several different areas here to establish truths in. Mathematical truths are examples of such truths. Hence, they're necessary, immutable, eternal, and they transcend human minds. They cannot not be true. So, you can see Augustine's answer to the question I raised at the beginning now. Could God make a world in which 7 plus 3 does not equal 10 without changing the meanings of the terms? And his answer is no. Okay. Now, there are folks that get very uncomfortable with this. They say that makes reason, that makes mathematics greater than God because God has to obey those laws. No, it's not saying that at all. It's saying that these things flow out of the nature of God. They express God's nature and God's consistency. And so they can't be any other way because God can't be untrue to himself. They're part of God's mind from eternity. What about the effectiveness? Here's an interesting statement that Augustine makes. He says, every material object, however mean, has its number. I was a little puzzled by this. A couple sentences later I read, and perhaps even God has his number. At this point, I got very uncomfortable. Is Augustine into some kind of weird numerology? Let me get rid of this book. Nevertheless, I persisted, went and talked to a Latin scholar friend of mine, and the word that's translated here, number, in Latin is numerus, excuse me, N-U-M-E-R-U-S, not O-U-S like in English. So a word like numerus has the obvious translation of number, but in Latin it has a much broader meaning than number. It also refers to pattern, form, or structure, and it's used that way in different contexts. And that seems to be the way that Augustine is using it here. So he's saying every material object has an underlying pattern behind it, which God used in the process of creating it. Take away that pattern, and the object itself ceases to be what it was as an object. Okay? So take away the form, and they cease to exist. All right. So mathematics then is effective, from Augustine's point of view, because the number of things, the pattern, existed in the mind of God at creation, and because we're created in the image of God. So God built the patterns into nature, and then he gave us the capacity and the capability of thinking in terms of those patterns so that we can understand the material world. For many purposes, so that we can understand what he's done, so we can worship him, and so we can exercise our stewardship over creation. Okay. Mathematics is very much involved with reason, and so I need to say just a little bit about Augustine's view of reason as well before we leave him. Reason for Augustine is a very simple definition. It's the ability to form and operate on abstract concepts. So operating on is easy. I mean, you think about if I take step A and I reason to step B and step C, that's clearly operating on abstract concepts. So I bring two concepts together and form a third one. Again, so that certainly is included. But he goes further than that. The whole process of forming abstract concepts. So if I look at some data and I infer a pattern from that and give it a name perhaps, I have created a new abstract concept, and that's a form of reason. So all that kind of scientific induction, as well as all of mathematical induction, are all part of what Augustine would regard as reason. It's how we learn anything, according to Augustine. But what this says is that the ontology of reason and the ontology of mathematical objects are quite different. Okay? What I mean by that is this. Mathematical objects, at least the basic ones, like numbers and perhaps a few abstractions from those, are eternal objects. They've existed in the mind of God from eternity. They're uncreated. Whereas reason is part of the created order. This is something that God has built into our capabilities. Now, presumably, from Augustine's point of view, God exists outside of time. God initiated time. Augustine goes to quite a bit of length to talk about the phrase at the beginning of Genesis, in the beginning, and says that God actually initiated time at that point. So God is the creator of time, exists outside of time. And so to God, all time is immediately present to him. So God does not need to reason. God does not need to think deductively because all truths are immediately present to him. However, reasoning implicitly is sequential. It says, if I have this, well, I can conclude this, I can conclude that. So there's definitely always a time dimension associated with reasoning. So in that sense, our thinking and God's thinking are necessarily quite different. We can never think like God in this sense. And the way we think is simply qualitatively different from the way that God thinks. Nevertheless, Pope Benedict addressed this very well in a recent talk he gave about 2 years ago at Regensburg. If you haven't had a chance to read it, I strongly recommend it. It's a wonderful talk on faith and reason. Just Google Benedict Regensburg and it'll pop right up for you. what he said was this. He said, the faith of the Church has always insisted between God and us, between his eternal creator spirit and our created reason. No, so you've got the eternal dimension here, the immutable, unchangeable, eternal, and then our created reason. There's just a real analogy. So even though we don't think like God, there's a strong analogy between them. If any of you are into Thomas Aquinas, this is very Thomistic here at this point. But as the Fourth Lateran Council in 1215 stated, shortly after the time of Aquinas, unlikeness remains infinitely greater than likeness. So God is infinitely different than us. But nevertheless, not to the point of abolishing analogy in its language. Benedict goes on to say that to act inconsistently with the demands of reason is to act inconsistently with the nature of God. That reason is so deeply, that reason takes its root, its normative power from God's consistency. And all of the basic rules of inference of logic are simply expressions of the law of non-contradiction in different forms. So fundamentally, reason draws its power from God's consistency, and as such, this is what gives it its normative power. And so in this sense, there's a strong analogy between our reasoning and God's nature through the vehicle of God's consistency. So where I go with this is to here. To my mind, then, correct reasoning becomes an expression of God's immanence. If we reason correctly, we are expressing the fundamental property of consistency, of God's consistency, and that's what gives that normative power. And so as we go through every step in any mathematical argument, no matter how small or how simple, we are in fact expressing at that moment God's immanence in our experience and in our world. I'm sure all of you have had the experience at some point in your life of successfully solving a mathematical problem or going through some sequence of reasoning and at the end had that feeling of, yes, I got it right. I'm confident in that. I know it. I would argue that that's an expression of the joy of the Lord. That is the imminence of God in each of those steps of reasoning, and that joy we find at the end is an expression of God's joy. Now, see how far we've come from the beginning? Mathematics over here, Christian belief over here, never the twain shall meet. In fact, we begin to find that mathematics and God are so intimately connected that every step of our thinking expresses in some form the imminence of our Creator. So we're a long ways away from never the twain shall meet. Well, let's take a look at one more person before we leave this theme. And that's Kepler. This is a famous quote, but I'd like to read it for you. I was merely thinking God's thoughts after him. Since we astronomers are priests of the highest God. Jennifer, did you think of yourself that way?
Absolutely.
In regard to the book of nature, it benefits us to be thoughtful not of the glory of our minds, but rather, above all else, of the glory of God. Now, Kepler goes quite a bit further than Augustine or Aquinas. Aquinas talks about an analogy between our thinking and God's thinking. Kepler goes so far as to say that in science, we actually have direct access to the mind of God. We are actually thinking God's thoughts after him. We're not just thinking a thought that's analogous to God's thought. We're actually thinking God's thoughts. I don't know where you go with this. I get uncomfortable. I'm okay with Aquinas, although I know some of my Reformed theologian friends even get uncomfortable with that. The very idea that we can say there's an analogy between our thinking and God's thinking is a little too much for them. They regard it as presumptuous. But I begin to get uncomfortable here with Kepler claiming that we actually have direct access to the mind of God. But nevertheless, this is a point of view that certainly up into the 16th century was not unusual. Kepler didn't feel at all uncomfortable at articulating this and saying this publicly. And this point of view prevailed for quite a long time. I'm going to jump up now to the 19th century, and the rest of my remarks here are going to be largely based on a book titled Equations from God by Daniel Cohen. Daniel Cohen is a historian from George Mason University. He published this book in 2007. And it's a study of the process of the secularization of mathematics. How, in a period of about 50 years, mathematics moved from a point of view where a strong relationship between mathematics and religious belief was pretty common to the point where it was virtually unheard of. In 19th century England, first half of the 19th century, a large number of mathematicians were clergy. A large number of clergy were trained in mathematics. It was not unusual to walk in the Church of England on a Sunday morning and hear a sermon in which mathematics played a very critical role. Mathematical truth and its certainty were seen as an exemplar of the confidence we can have in God's revelation and in Christian truth. The wonders of creation were seen as evidence of the glory of God. These were common themes from the pulpit in the early part of the 19th century, almost unheard of today. Even a person as famous as George Boole, the founder of Boolean algebra, Boolean logic, the basis of the computer, called the father of pure mathematics by Bertrand Russell. When Boole died, his wife wrote this. Mathematics had never had more than a secondary interest for him. And even logic he cared for chiefly as a means of clearing the ground of doctrines imagined to be proved by showing that the evidence on which they were supposed to give rest had no tendency to prove them. But he had been endeavoring to give a more active and positive help than this to the cause of what he deemed pure religion. Boole was a Protestant teaching in a Catholic university in Ireland, and his mission in life, as he saw it, was to reconcile Protestantism and Catholicism. Well, as you can see, he was notably unsuccessful. But nevertheless, he devoted a great deal of energy to this, and his motivation for studying logic was fundamentally a religious motivation. He came out of that kind of a mindset and framework. Okay? So far removed from the kind of culture that we have today. What happened? Well, the secularization of mathematics took place in this 50-year period, between about 1850 and 1900. There's several reasons. Here's two key ones. Poor apologetics and some events within mathematics. Let me spell this out a little bit. There was a fellow named Oliver Byrne in 1839 that wrote a book called The Creed of St. Athanasius, Proved by a Mathematical Parallel. How many of you here have ever read the Athanasian Creed? Well, some of you have. Okay. It's fairly lengthy for a creed. It's highly Trinitarian, and it puts a strong emphasis on God's infiniteness. And so Byrne, who was a devout Christian, decided to put together a mathematical argument for the truth of the Athanasian Creed. Right? And the book goes on for quite a bit of length, but you can summarize it all down to this one line that's written here at the bottom. You see, you've got God the Father, who's infinite, God the Son, who's infinite, the Holy Spirit, who's infinite, the three together, and you have an infinite God, and this proves the Holy Trinity. Well, if Byrne had simply presented this as a cute little analogy, kind of fun, doesn't this help us understand the Trinity better, perhaps? Everybody, I think, would have received it well, and it would not have been a problem. Byrne did not do this. He presented it as a formal mathematical treatise, used the word proved in his title, and the result was that the mathematics community was embarrassed. And they simply began to try to move away, to set as much distance as they could between themselves and this kind of thinking. Now, I want to mention this partly just because it's part of the process of secularization, but also I wanted to mention as a caution to us, as we think seriously about how to relate our faith and our scientific disciplines, we got to be careful, because it's possible to give offense, and it's possible to, in fact, set greater distance between people and the faith rather than drawing them closer if we don't respect the professional standards of our discipline and respect them with great care. Okay? And that's what happened in Byrne's case. He was a sincere man, really trying to do what he thought was right to advance the kingdom of God. All right, so within mathematics, during the late 18th, early 19th century was becoming more rigorous. What had happened was that calculus had been discovered, invented, whichever you prefer, in the late 17th century, early part of the 18th century. Within about 100 years, a number of inconsistencies in it began to show up. And the way these were resolved was largely through making mathematics more and more rigorous. Well, it was an effective tool, but it also had the effect of separating mathematics more and more from popular culture. It became more specialized, more remote. Professionalization, the mathematics community began to develop a self-identity, began to put together professional organizations, again, became more separated. I'll say more about that in a minute. Non-Euclidean geometry. Euclidean geometry had been seen as fundamental truth about nature, about reality. This was not simply an abstract mathematical structure. This was truth, and it told us the way things really worked. Well, with non-Euclidean geometry, suddenly it wasn't so clear now that mathematics was giving us truth about the natural world. So mathematics was now separated from nature, as well as separated from culture and off into a separate community. Bertrand Russell began to try to derive all of mathematics from logic. In other words, mathematics becomes a product simply of the human mind. It needs nothing beyond it. And David Hilbert even went so far as to say mathematics is an abstract, separate formal discipline that has no need for God or anything beyond itself. Okay. Let me just say a little bit about the professionalization and a little bit about formalism and skip over the others for now. let's start with the professionalization. And forgive me for this rather long quote, actually two quotes. Again, can you folks in the back see it? All right. Just to be sure, let me read through it with you because this is so critical for what I'm trying to say that I really want to be sure that we take enough time to really understand it. Augustus De Morgan was a very, very influential mathematician around the middle of the 19th century. He'd been born in the early part of the 19th century of missionary parents overseas. Around in his early 20s, he had rebelled against his parents' faith. To the end of his life, he always maintained some kind of a belief in the fatherhood of God, although it was rather vague, and it certainly was not in any sense a Christian concept of God. He was very, very influential in logic. He was also the founder of the London Mathematical Society. And that's the key point from our perspective. Because the structure, the social structure that he built into the London Mathematical Society is described in these two quotations. Okay? The London Mathematical Society became the pattern on which the American Mathematical Society was founded, and it also became the pattern that shaped all the mathematical societies in the world. All right, let's read through the quotation together. Where religious sects constantly bickered, mathematicians would discuss matters peacefully. Where polemical fanatics overstated their cases, mathematicians would be cautious in their proclamations. Where amateur mathematicians and arrogant metaphysicians discussed grand notions, professional mathematicians would limit their purview. Where the evils of dogma and religious establishment smothered nonconformity, mathematicians would be open to the new and different as long as dogma and religion were not involved. And then to achieve this, again back to Cohen is saying here, mathematicians would have to sacrifice the age-old transcendental characterization of their discipline, right? Ideas in the mind of God. Okay? They would no longer claim that mathematics was a divine language, because it then became a proper subject for clergymen and mystics as well. They could no longer assert that mathematics was perfect and infallible, because it then became a new dogmatic church like the one they struggled against. No longer could they even flaunt the supreme precision of mathematics, because that was just the sort of hubris they disparaged in contemporary intellectual discourse. Remember the picture we saw at the beginning? Mathematics here, Christian belief here, and never the twain shall meet. We can see where it came from. Okay? It originated here in this thinking of De Morgan, and it became institutionalized in the London Mathematical Society, subsequently in the rest of the world's mathematical societies, and it has become a defining characteristic of the mathematical community, even in its informal identity as well as its formal identity as a professional organization. So this distinction, mathematics and Christian belief have nothing to do with each other, is that way because people made it that way. It does not have to be that way. All right, where do we go with it then? Well, let me give you the quote by Hilbert before we go further. Hilbert was probably the most influential mathematician of the 20th century. He wrote, "The fundamental idea of my proof theory is none other than to describe the activity of our understanding. That is, mathematics is fundamentally a product simply of human intellect. Nothing transcendent. Okay? To make a protocol of the rules by which our understanding actually proceeds. Already at this time, I'd like to assert what the final outcome will be. Mathematics is a presuppositionless science. To found it, I do not need God or a special faculty of our understanding." Okay. So again, first we got the structures of the professional organizations set up to exclude God, and now we have the most influential, most highly respected mathematician of the 20th century reinforcing that kind of a notion. Well, what are we to make of this effort to establish the autonomy of mathematics, and what do we do? It's really a problem. It's a problem for me. It's been one all my professional career, this sort of almost schizophrenia that you have to live in, your faith life over here, professional life over here. How do you function with these two worlds that are so completely separated? Well, let's think about this autonomy for a minute. If we grant that reason is rooted in the nature of God, as I claimed earlier, I want to assert that the secular position on mathematics has fundamental intellectual and spiritual problems. Let me walk you through what I see here. First of all, the assertion of human autonomy from God is the essence of sin, right? Isn't that what sin is all about? Saying, God, I don't need you. Thanks, but no thanks. I can do this on my own. So I think that this whole movement we see is fundamentally rooted in human sinfulness. It's in the fall of human beings. But I want to be careful in saying that, because I don't want to sound like I'm saying that the mathematics that's been done in the past 150 years is therefore sinful or flawed or fallen. I think we're back to the gold of the Egyptians. There's been wonderful mathematics done in the last 150 years, beautiful mathematics, extraordinarily useful and profound, as well as just being beautiful in and of its own right. And I think we as Christians are free to appropriate that and to use it. So I don't want in any way disparage the mathematics itself. I'm talking more about the driving force between the formation of the community and the separation of mathematical thinking from religious belief. All right, secondly, I want to claim that this attempt to separate mathematics and faith so strongly starts from a false premise. Let me use a metaphor first in the science-religion debate. I'm sure you're all familiar with the idea of the God of the gaps argument. You know, this is the kind of approach that Christians sometimes use. They say that, well, science can't explain X, therefore we need God to account for that. Okay? That's a God of the gaps argument, and it always is like waving a red flag in front of the atheist bull. As soon as you say that science can't explain that, what does the scientist do? Immediately says, all right, I'm going to find a naturalistic way to do that. And usually the Christian ends up looking bad. And sure enough, the scientist does find such an explanation. It never works. Well, almost never works. This is the inverse of that same argument from the atheistic perspective. If science can explain X, then we don't need God to explain it. But they're both the scientists and both the atheistic scientists and the Christians are using the same fundamental logical structure in this God of the gaps argument. Well, there's a mathematical analog of this, which Russell and Hilbert are using. If mathematics can be cut loose from moorings in anything external to itself, it doesn't need God or anything external to human thought. But if you think about the Augustinian perspective for a second, if mathematics existed in the mind of God before creation, it certainly is separable from the physical universe. If God has built this into human thought, it certainly expresses the structure of human thought. So it shouldn't surprise us at all that mathematics can be explained in terms of the structure of human thought and that it can be separated from the physical universe. But in no sense does the conclusion of this argument follow. So it's a false premise to say that if mathematics can be cut loose, then we don't need God. All right, thirdly, there's some things that the secular perspective on mathematics just simply can't handle. There are some gaps that I guess I would call essential gaps. There are inessential gaps and there are essential gaps. I think there's some essential gaps. There's no way from a naturalistic perspective to account for the certitude that mathematics provides, and it also does not account for the effectiveness of mathematics in describing physical reality. Okay, and fourth and last point, the radical separation of mathematics and belief, I want to suggest, fractures human thought. What I mean by that is this. The Enlightenment definition of reason was different than Augustine's definition. The Enlightenment definition was that reason is a combination of empiricism and mathematical reasoning. So you've got scientific induction, mathematical deduction, and that exhausts the nature of reason. Okay. But this clearly excludes ethics. People have tried for years to try to develop structures or systems of ethics without any reference to religion, totally on empirical grounds. A lot of people have tried. Nobody's ever been very successful at it. These arguments never seem to work very well. And so ethics ends up being rendered kind of outside the scope of reason. Culture in the sense of critique of culture, if all you have is empiricism and mathematics, how can you ever put together a critique of culture? How can you ever say that this particular cultural structure is not appropriate? All you have to do is you say, oh, this culture is what it is. All we can do is accept it and say, that's okay. There's another culture over here. There's a different structure. That's their structure. And we can look at them empirically. There's no basis of putting together any kind of a critique of culture. And certainly religion is outside the scope of reason. Look at the result of this. This is a very odd phenomenon. The Enlightenment was called the Age of Reason. It glorified reason. It made reason central. And yet, it narrows the scope of reason. The Enlightenment would look at religion as somehow being irrational or less than rational. In fact, Christian belief gives a much higher view of reason and a broader scope to it. Because it brings all of these other areas within the scope of what can be dealt with by the methods of reason. Okay. So, an alternative view would see mathematics as part of a vastly richer web of thought that finds its meaning and purpose in God. Okay, so some implications, and then I'm going to stop. The Augustinian view of mathematics, it seems to me, is inspiring. The capacity to do mathematics is a gift of God. Its content originates in God. A mathematical career is a calling to think about God's wonders. It leads to service of his kingdom and to worship. But The culture, the professional culture of mathematics is antithetical to such a perspective. What can we do? Well, this culture was created by people. Should we be working to try to transform it? Should we be trying to change that culture in some way? If so, in what ways? What's appropriate? Is it appropriate simply to say, well, let's work for a less technical view of mathematics, one that's more culturally embedded, that sets a higher value on history, philosophy, culture, and so forth, a more humanistic view of mathematics? What are some of the other structures? What are the appropriate ways for Christians to live in this mathematical culture that's been defined explicitly as un-Christian? I don't have the answer to that, but that's something I think we need to address in our discussion questions. Okay, more information. If you want to pursue these things any further beyond what I've said here, here's a couple references I can give you. If you go to that website, the ACMS, Association of Christians in the Mathematical Sciences, the first reference there is a paper that, that I've written that's posted there based on the kind of ideas I've talked about with you here. The second is a review of Daniel Cohen's book. It'll give you about a five-page summary of the main ideas. And if you want to look up the book itself, I strongly recommend it. It's really a very good read for anybody that's interested in these kinds of questions. I think at this point I'll stop.
Thank you very much. We have time for a few questions, and then we're going to break up into discussion groups. So does anybody have a question for Dr. Bradley right now?
I have a question. You're talking about concepts as being something in the mind of God. It almost sounds as if that obviously the understanding that it exalts mathematics almost to the same level as the moral law, that God can't be evil. God can't have one plus one not equal two. It's a very interesting view of mathematics.
It is. Can you hear me okay? Yeah. Benedict has an interesting comment about this. He takes the view that God's consistency, and since all of mathematics, is indeed part of God, but God's love is greater than that. In other words, that there are gradations of importance, if you like, within the nature of God. And so you've got the mathematics in here, and then, of course, the moral law would come out of God's love, so it would be set at a higher level, even though both are within God. I don't know if that's satisfactory or not.
So, Mr. Augustine's, examples of truth seem to be arguable, at least from some standpoint, and I don't know, maybe that's just a breakdown of reasoning, a failure of reasoning. So I was kind of wondering about that, and then how does that apply towards, you know, truth in math, then? And then secondly, what does it mean to add one to God, then? Is that, possible? Is God the infinite number, then? And does that mean that there's God infinity because of God?
As for the first question, I would agree with you that they are arguable. By putting him up here, in no way was I asserting that he was right. I personally find the assertion that the mathematical truths are immutable, unchangeable, a stronger argument than these other ones. excuse me. As for the adding one to God idea, there's some very, very interesting work that's been done over the past 100 years or so on the concept of infinity. And I don't know if you're familiar with the idea of the hierarchy of infinities, larger cardinal numbers, and some of these kinds of things. There's nobody, as far as I can tell, that sat down and really tried to think through the theological implications of this. There's one person in Germany who's been working on this a little bit. I talked to him about it when we were in China with Jennifer. He said, no, he said, I don't think I'm going to work on that. I'm involved in some other things right now. So it's really an open question in terms of what I think what you're asking. And I think there's a real need for someone to address that.
Mm-hmm. Can you describe a situation or a time where working on some mathematical thing in particular helped you feel closer to God or where you felt God's presence?
That's not an unusual experience, believe it or not. I'll tell you one. Well, you know, I talked about this idea of coming to sense that, that every step in a mathematical proof was an extent, an experience of God's immanence. When I saw that, and I began to realize that for the first time, or at least think it was true, you may not think I was right, but I felt like the proverbial fish that was discovering the water. You know, that I had lived my whole professional career working on mathematics and doing these kinds of things and doing this kind of reasoning, and never had appreciated the fact that God was present in that every moment. And it was just an absolutely awe-inspiring moment for me, and very humbling. But I think every mathematician has an experience of some sort of sense of beauty and wonder in their work in mathematics. And to my mind, that has a significance beyond my own experience. It's transcendent. It points beyond itself to the Creator.
That was a great question. I'm going to finish up with one that's more of a devil's advocate kind of question. Is there some sense in which keeping the sort of religious view of mathematics out of it is actually a good thing, that it kind of frees it from baggage, if you will, so that all of us, Christians and non-Christians alike, can work together, can use mathematics in our various fields, and then come to our philosophical interpretations as we like? I mean, is there some sense in which it's useful not to, to see mathematics from a kind of bigger religious perspective? Or is that just a wrong way of looking at it? What do you think?
No, I'm glad you asked that question, because I think it helps restore some balance.
Okay.
Yeah, in fact, if you look back at the De Morgan quote, here, let me just go back to it. I mean, you could say that De Morgan is really being very well-intentioned here, right? He wants to avoid all these kinds of sectarian controversies. And he's not that long after the Reformation. You know, so some of that pain is still being felt in Europe of all of the kind of religious conflicts that people experience. And so he wants something that's going to free him from all that. So in that sense, yeah, that's why I think we have to be very cautious in how we proceed.
And that's one of the reasons I kind of like science. In some, in its best case, is that I can sort of get out of some of the more unhealthy debates and dialogue in popular culture and work with people in a variety of backgrounds and things. And so I just wondered if there's some balance to this kind of
music. Yeah, yeah. And some of it may be a matter of how we personally perceive it, too.
Right.
And Augustine at one point makes the comment, he says that you never really understand the meaning of anything until you see how it points to Christ. And I think that's, you know, that's how we can think about our own work in science or mathematics. Go ahead, Troy.
I was just going to say that reading De Morgan's words as a Christian mathematician, I hear humility in that. As opposed to error.
Yeah, I'm not judging his motives, but what I'm saying is the consequence of it was a structure, a social structure, that excluded the possibility of thinking about the relationship between mathematics and belief.
Well, let's think.
One more.
Kind of question.
In line of your remark, was this in time parallel to Huxley's attempts to push religion and clergy out of social power and bring science and mathematics into a more exalted and powerful position?
My history may be weak here, but I think it was about a generation earlier. But nevertheless, it's still part of that late 19th century British culture. You're right.
Let's give a round of applause for Jim. Thank you so much.